Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Aaron Costiganis, who you may have seen in A New York Love Story, or Straight Outta Tompkins, or as Bobby in the fifth episode of Jessica Jones, a.k.a. The Sandwich Saved Me. He'll soon be seen in Galen Connell's Blood, Sand, and Gold, and you can catch him right now opposite Lucas Nieuwenbrug in Tim Kirkman's new drama Lazy Eye, which was released on VOD just last month. Aaron picked The Fisher King, Terry Gilliam's 1991 drama, written by Richard Legrevenis, starring Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams as two deeply damaged men who stumble into one another on a heroic quest through New York City, though that is, of course, a ridiculous oversimplification. The Fisher King is a testament to the appeal of fantasy when things are at their most chaotic and horrific, and to the way personal connections are the only thing that can save us from ourselves. It's probably my favorite of Gilliam's films, and it was a delight to be able to dig into it over Thanksgiving in a room at the Ace Hotel in Manhattan that was not quite as quiet as we would have liked. But that seems somehow appropriate. Chaos gets into everything. This is someone else's movie.
I think I was actually driving yesterday and thinking, what do I want to talk about? There was like absolutely no reason for it in any like, oh, because Mercedes Rule is so astonishing, or like, oh, because this moment is, it's like, no, I don't know. Something about that movie just feels like hyper real in me right now. So, and I don't know why. Let's figure out why.
Okay.
Let's unpack it.
This is great. No, the impulse choice is always the most interesting
one.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
Well, next obvious question, what was your first experience of it? When did you first see it?
I saw that movie for the first time when I was like, probably in my early teens. I tend to do this thing where I like go through director to director opposed to like actor to actor. So I was on a Terry Gilliam trip.
Nice.
After having finished like I think everything that Monty Python could have created, I found most of it. And then I sort of branched out into all of his movies and I was like, wait, he made that and that and that? And something about Fisher King I feel like resonated in a way that was like really unique to me in a way that I hadn't seen anything like it, and he's such a singular directorial voice.
Yeah.
The way that he operates, the way that he orients shots, and the way that he uses, you know, specific angles or specific perspectives to kind of like give you an eye into what's going on, it feels like it really does bring that conversation of like the art of filmmaking to a real place where I'm as a viewer, I'm like, oh, I see this is all on purpose. Everything was thought out in a way that makes me tired. You know, it's just like, I'm like, God, that would take so much time, and so much thought. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe I'd have to talk to him. Maybe it's just like,
it's like the innate impulse too.
Yeah, maybe he just like, maybe he knows. Maybe there's something in that way that like a musician sits down and writes a song in 5 minutes and you're like, how did you come up with the, how did you, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it just came out. Yeah. Like, maybe there's something about, he's dead, isn't he?
Gilliam?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, good, he's still alive.
No.
I was just like, I said that, I was like, I just gotta talk to him. And I'm like, wait, did he die recently?
He just turned 70 last
year. I'm just assuming it because it's 2016 that he has also died.
Not yet.
No, yeah.
We're hanging tough.
Okay, good.
No,
thank God.
Yeah, he's hearty.
Man. Yeah.
He's incredibly hale. I think I've said this on the podcast before, one of the greatest accomplishments of my life over 30 years in this career is that Terry Gilliam vaguely knows who I am.
Oh my God, congratulations.
Yeah, I've interviewed him a number of times. And he
amazing.
Yeah, I know I've told this story. I flew myself to New York in 95 for a 5-movie junket weekend, the big Christmas weekend, and it was explicitly for 12 Monkeys, just so I could meet him, because I was young, and then I could game out the stories that I was selling to make it all work out.
Yeah.
But it was so great. He is the sweetest, nicest, most doomed person
Like doomed.
He is the man who responds to tragedy or not even tragedy, but he has the worst luck of any creative person I know, because, you know, like the whole Don Quixote thing.
Yep.
That is who he was before this. At the premiere of the movie of 12 Monkeys, the first screening, the press screening, it was the big red carpet gala. Bruce Willis walked in ahead of me. It was kind of weird.
You're like, this is normal.
Yeah. And it was just insane. But it was this great big theater with a balcony, and that's where they put the press. We were up there. Mm-hmm. And the sound was out of sync immediately, and he just leapt up and ran. I saw this tiny figure, and it was clearly him just go ping and run like, to the projection.
Not today, Satan.
Yeah, no, like this, and this is 1995, and this is all of the world is going wrong for him all the time, and he still manages to pull these amazing works of art out of this insane chaos. And like, even the fact that he was working with Universal 10 years after Brazil, where they just gutted this movie, we talked about that.
Yeah, Brazil remains in my top. It's been my favorite. It was my favorite film for such a long time that I feel weird about saying it's my favorite film. In the way that you would like should be getting like, get tired of a tattoo, probably, because like you've changed and like the light, like life has moved on, but like. That movie also, in a way, like really brought like cinema to another level for me as I think as an actor and as an audience member, to see like what I could expect out of that, out of this medium.
Right.
What kind of imagination a human being can. It's a thing of like you watch like an incredible, like a beautiful sequence in a movie, and you're like, gee, golly, how did that come from somebody? How did somebody? Did they articulate that in the exact way that they? Because it looks like it's it looks like it's probably as well articulated as it could be. Is that how that person imagined that? And like, what kind of words did they have to use to express? Like, I want it to be. I want the person to be like moving with like through the cloud and then fly through. Like, and then like I want the cloud to be like this shape, and then they want them to move through the cloud at this exact angle and pop up, and then you see a wing first, but then you don't see the face, but you see.
Yeah.
Like, what did they have to say? Or, like, how did it, to be able to get that image on screen? Like, that kind of thing. And Terry seems like one of these directors who has such an immense visual vocabulary that, like, I mean, I imagine he just never gets bored. It seems like one of those people who just could never be bored in life.
He doodles compulsively.
He gets
sketchy. He starts to just write things down.
That makes so much sense.
And I think that's how he becomes that director, too.
Right.
Working in animation in the 60s, where it's all handmade, he was literally doing everything.
Right.
So he knows how to do it.
Right.
And I think that plus the 50mm lens, like his reliance on that flat proscenium sort of thing, has always been to his advantage as a creator, because if you can't do what he wants, he can show you how.
Oh my God.
And as far as I know, he's not like the James Cameron kind of engineer who it's like do it or get out of the way.
Right.
Gilliam's much more collaborative. Like, no actor has ever had a negative thing to say about him. And just, you know, the fact that when Heath Ledger died on Parnassus, he could just recruit three other actors to jump in and help out the second half.
And also to have the mind to think like, I refuse to give up on this thing. In fact, I'm going to just change it.
Yeah, this is the
that kind of like lack. You know, like you see somebody when somebody's something great about somebody. There's always this like little piece of it is that they're like they're not precious. I find this with like really great actors that I've worked with, or like really wonderful directors who I've worked with. There's this incredible kind of like laissez-faire attitude about things. Like if something's not going well, instead of dwelling, you just simply change direction.
Right,
and that's. I don't understand how that happens, because I don't know how to do that yet as a human being. But it feels like something that's kind of like elevated and like monkish.
Yeah, I think it's just knowing the ultimate goal for him.
Maybe right? It's
like
that,
he knows what the movie's going to look like when it's finished.
Right.
And so we'll get there. You know, you'll get there.
With any luck.
Yeah, and if you've seen Lost in La Mancha, you know what happens when it doesn't get there. He has that giggle that kicks in every time. Oh, we're all going to die. We're doomed. This is great.
Yeah.
He's going to enjoy the ride somehow. And I've no idea how you get to that point, like that kind of zen where you're okay with chaos.
It's just failing so much.
Yeah.
It's just like having such a real experience of failing so severely, so frequently. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, you know what? I know how low it can go, so like may as well just kind of keep trucking, because like we're not there yet.
Yeah. And The Fisher King, weirdly enough, is the film that people don't think about because it's it's not his... I guess it is his least Gilliam-y movie. Other than The Red Knight, there's not much that's...
Right, there's like nothing...
It's pretty gritty. It's pretty realistic. It's, it finds a frame for his flights of fancy.
Yeah.
But...
And feels actually kind of like... I mean, he's always vaguely sentimental, but there's something about that movie that feels very kind of like sentimental in like a very linear kind of like normal way where you can kind of like you can figure it. You're like, oh, I see and that makes sense and this makes sense. And yeah, there's nothing like hyper fantastical about it. Yeah. That
or the things that are fantastical are excused. They're
yeah,
provided
right.
for.
Right. This is part of his madness.
Yeah.
So like that's why we're seeing this.
Yeah, the Grand Central Station dance number and that elaborate. I'm constantly amazed at like coming back to The Fisher King over and over again over the years. This is 25 years old now, which is unthinkable to me.
Yeah.
At how weirdly, once again, like it's completely relevant.
Yeah.
America's failure to deal with mental illness and it opens with a mass shooting and it's all these things in talk radio, aggressive talk radio.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed. It still feels of the moment. The only thing that's missing is a cell phone.
Yeah.
And it's, and also the, just the incredible cynical depiction of television executives.
Yeah.
It's all there. Like nothing has changed. It's, it's weirdly pressing.
So depressing. And also just like, well, we'll get through this.
Right.
You know, there's something kind of like sort of optimistic about the whole process.
Yeah.
The thing that I find so weird and funny about it is I never remember how it ends until I've like just about gotten to the ending again. And I've seen the movie now, I don't know, maybe like 5 or 6 times.
Okay.
There's something about that where like, you know, there are these moments that have kind of like found their way into my own like little mythology, like, you know, also thinking about like Amanda Plummer, I'm like, where did she go?
Yeah.
There's something about her that's so like wonderful and so perfectly innocent and like vaguely frightening and like and also there's something about her that, as you know, in relation to like Robin Williams' character, you're like, because you see his wife in this like former life that he lives as like this Hunter College professor, and she kind of fills this very kind of like prototypical, like, you know, arm candy of like this beautiful like bouncing blonde kind of like, you know, you imagine them at these like bougie restaurants like living the high life. And now there's something about, as he's changed, as he's kind of gone through this like massive, you know, as he has gone through loss and has sort of also lost his mind, his preference has changed or something, or he sees, you don't get to know this other wife, but you get to see Amanda Plummer's character. It's like this deeply flawed, like deeply human, you know, busybody who works in an office, who is effectively anonymous. And there's something about that and her idiosyncrasies and her like lack of her inability to sort of just do the thing like it's supposed to, as it's supposed to be done.
Yeah.
That she's like off, you know, like outside of the lines and like off, quite off the rail. Something about that is what's appealing to him now. And he sees this like almost like this kind of perfection in her. And the fact that she can't conform, which is really, something about that is so, I always thought it was so lovely. And yet she's like, you can kind of get her. There's nothing that's like, it's so articulate and so specific that you can kind of, when he's like confessing his love to her or whatever that is.
Yeah.
On the steps, it's like coffee, that little coffee monologue. Something about that that feels so like, so precise and really like, everybody can get that. There's a, it's like this, you know, this, what is it? What do you say? Like, I have a hard on for you the size of Florida.
Yes.
That's just, it's so good. That's so wonderful. Anyway.
The little moments where Robin Williams kind of infects the character in exactly the right way.
Yeah.
Perry is And again, it's the thing where you have something that pre-exists. I mean, it was a script by the Revenies. It was
yeah.
It was not necessarily written for Williams.
Yeah.
But it couldn't have been played. By the time the film is over, there's no one else you can imagine. Like, even right. And Bridges is phenomenal.
Right.
But that's a role that you could drop yeah, somebody could else kinda, into.
Yeah, yeah,
it
right.
It wouldn't dramatically alter. It has that
like,
kind of
like Eric Bogosian like talk radio vibe anyway. Sure. Like you can yeah. throw like... anybody with a big personality who can cry.
Yeah.
You're like, great. That's perfect. That's like Liev Schreiber. That's like any of those kind of like bros.
Right.
Which Jeff Bridges does. I mean, not just that he doesn't do like a great job with yeah. it, but yeah.
But there's an element of swagger that's sort of generic. I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
yeah.
The role is any guy who's kind of like that.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah. Which, and Bridges, I think only Bridges could do that weird little eyelid twitch oh in extreme close up. I asked him about that once.
Really?
Yeah. My incredible luck to have I've interviewed, except for Williams, who I only glancingly saw once in a restaurant. I have interviewed everybody else who was involved with it.
Yeah.
And Bridges is like, yeah, that took no time at all. You just find it. And yeah. I'm like, what do you even mean? That's actor talk. Tell me how you did it.
Right.
He's just like,
and. It's like, and that is it.
Yeah. No, he just said, like, by the time they shot it, he knew how to do it. And
yeah.
I was like, okay, I guess, but that's really frustrating.
Right. Well, it's interesting how that kind of, I think in any other movie that character would have been, you know, this, you know, I guess, I don't know how to put it, like maybe the, like a character actor's opus, like somebody that could like really get in there and get, but because he's surrounded by such eccentricities, yeah. he becomes a straight man.
He has to, yeah.
He has to.
Grounded.
Yeah, and I think something about that is kind of, also I think that's also a sign of like a great actor for Jeff Bridges' ability to kind of like move over a little bit, knowing that he is the centerpiece of the film,
right.
In a way, he's also able to kind of give due space and time to all of the greatness around him.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about that that's sort of one of those unspoken things that like as an actor, you kind of understand when you're only when you're in like relationship to another person, another actor.
Yeah. It's funny because Williams, there are two films. There's this and there's Good Will Hunting yeah. where the movie doesn't start out to be about him. He's not even a factor. And then all of a sudden you realize about two-thirds of the way through, it's like, I'm like, oh, way more invested.
Right. You're like,
yeah.
And I can't stop paying attention yeah. to everything that he's doing.
Yeah. And it's not Matt Damon's fault in Good Will Hunting. Right. And it's not like the movie's named for him.
Right.
And,
right.
And it certainly Bridges carries the Fisher King.
Right.
But somehow just I'm... there's no overbearing aspect of it.
Yeah.
Williams just comes in and takes over in a way that feels absolutely organic. And clearly that's the movie's intention.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting through it the first time in a tiny press screening in the basement in the old Famous Players screening room in Toronto because it was playing at TIFF.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
Columbia had this early screening for us in August. And
yeah.
So we went there and saw this movie in the dark and just came out 2.25 hours later just blown
was
away.
Was everyone as excited like, then?
We just, no one knew anything about it. It was like,
yeah.
Oh, this is the new Gilliam film. Okay, cool. But at that time...
What had just preceded, like, where was he in his...
He was the gargantuan troubled auteur who had made Brazil and then Baron Munchausen.
Right.
This colossal misfire,
yep.
But like publicly determined to be the critic. No one went to see it and the critics were mixed.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, this is his film where he proves he can make a movie again
yeah.
with a studio.
Right.
And it turns out to be... maybe not his masterpiece, but certainly the best contemporary project he's ever done.
Yeah.
And you just walk out going, oh, well, so that was great.
Yeah, yeah.
And we all had to go be quiet by ourselves for a little while.
Right, and then it
wins the People's Choice Award
uh-huh.
and picks up a little momentum. Now, of course, that would mean that the studio gets behind it and puts it for the Oscars.
Yeah,
but
right.
it got, what did it, it won Best Supporting Actress for Mercedes Rule.
Yeah,
for
Mercedes Rule, yeah.
Who we haven't even mentioned yet, who's equally as great as being the straight character
oh, God.
As Bridges is, in a way that, does, like that's the thing about the movie. No one is the straight person, really, because right. everyone is allowed to be invested fully in their weird eccentricities and idiosyncrasies. Yeah. And Rule, I mean, I remember being really surprised when she got the nomination, but because it's this big, brassy, loud,
right.
But she's also as much of a truth teller as Perry is in her way. Like her purpose
yeah.
in the story is to serve dignity and honesty.
Well, there's something about that that's so. You know, when you get to watch a character who lets themselves kind of be peeled away
mm-hmm.
in a way that's like, it's really, I think it really is like the more stuff that I see, the more I realize it's, there's something about that that is so that has such artistry in it, the kind of ability, and also like, cause like, I don't know how that was shot, but I imagine it wasn't sequential. And there's no possible way.
Big production numbers, yeah.
That like there's a way that, and also the, you know, the way that her stuff was so kind of like, in a way like isolated through the storyline. Like she has these really like kind of like little bit like little piecemeal here and there, and gets like then gets a big thing, and then like piecemeal, and then like a big thing,
yeah.
And just to kind of plot that as a, just to, for her to have plotted that so intelligently, and like and find like the little kernels of that character that by the time she is able to kind of confess her love and is just so desperately wanting to have it, you know, returned, to be so heartbroken by that. It's she, like, each character has like a perfect moment of heartbreak in that movie, you know. You know, it's, I think for Amanda Plummer, it's that moment on the steps where, you know, where Robin Williams has that like perfect confession of like, you know, how he doesn't even drink coffee and he doesn't need to stay over, but you know, he just wants to see her again, and having that little hope re-enter her life is just so it's so rewarding for the, like, for, I mean, for me it was. And then there's like this like little quiet moment, I actually missed it last when I was rewatching this, where it's like Robin Williams, who is when he wakes up from his coma,
right,
in the hospital after, like, also, like, how weird that he gets, you know, the, like, after, like, you think of, like, Terry Gilliam and, like, the Holy Grail, and you're like, he gets a grail in this? It's, yeah, a little bit...
You know,
let's,
yeah,
like, let's, but let's go for it. Sure, fine, great. And, of course, it's not a Holy Grail. It's just, like, some, it's, what is it, like, some commemorative cup from, like, some Christmas something from, like, the 20s that this old man won. He's like, well, this'll do.
Yeah.
Because, right, it doesn't have to be real. It's like, it's everything has such a symbolic significance in the movie. So, like, you know, Robin Williams, like, wakes up after, you know, receiving his Holy Grail, and Jeff Bridges has collapsed on him and sleeps on him overnight, I think is the idea. And Robin Williams just wakes up and whispers, which I think I've missed almost every time, which I, so much so that I had to go back and, like, I was like, wait, what did he say something that I missed there? And I think I've done it because I realized, I was like, I've done this before. And I went back and, like, I Googled the script, had to scroll through the script, and I was like, what did he say in that moment? And it's, mm-hmm, something like, maybe you remember, but it's something like, I miss her, Jack. Is it okay to miss her now?
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh God. Ugh. Like now he can begin to grieve.
Yeah.
And all the madness that he's been kind of going through in his life is just, he doesn't, it's a thing of like, he just doesn't want to accept that he's lost her.
Well, yeah, and certainly, like, just disappearing into the fugue. It's hinted, if not explicitly stated, that,
yeah,
all of this is related to his trauma, but also, right, I think just the fact of the Grail being a psychosomatic cure.
Yeah, right.
Kind of nails it at the end. It's like, yep, now this is what happens when you can't process. Like, he's,
right,
he's shut down his rational self, and now he can start to become a person again.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that too, because it means that, like, Perry, which, yeah, wasn't even his real name, he was calling himself that for, mm-hmm, Percival. Who is this guy really? We never really get to meet him.
No.
Is he going to be a dick to the new girlfriend? Like,
right, right,
work?
Right.
How's that,
right,
going to work?
How does like sane Perry operate? Was he a jerk?
Yeah. Well, and this is,
like,
Time Bandits ends with Kevin's parents dying.
Right,
and
right,
kids,
right,
abandoned and alone. It's like, mm-hmm, that's in line with...
Well, this is the thing with the movie that I keep forgetting is, I'm like, like I said, every time I watch the damn thing, I keep forgetting. I'm like, does it end? I think it ends... terribly with Jeff Bridges' character just being like getting back on track and like back on his feet, and he's like, you know what, I'm gonna go live my life, and now you've given me, like, I've had this time to like get my act together, and now I don't need you anymore and I'm gone. And for some reason I always forget that there's like this whole like redemptive end to,
yeah,
it, where like the last 20 minutes we have to watch him be redeemed. Which, because it is kind of like this weird quest movie, you know,
it's, so, yeah,
yeah, and it's just like, you're like, wait, is this like, am I just watching this kind of like you know, sort of dystopic sort of like rom-com? Or is it like, no, there's actually something very real and kind of like driven about the quest of this movie, about everybody like everybody moving towards something, whether it be like, you know, toward finding an actual holy grail or something more subtle, like how to move on past like your own grief.
Yeah. It's kind of remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, really beautiful. And it's one of those movies I can kind of, sometimes I have trouble watching movies more than once because I sort of like, I start finding the flaws and it makes me angry. I'm just like, let's just gloss over this. I know it wasn't perfect, but like, let's just sort of appreciate it for what it was and like not talk about it anymore.
Right.
But this is one of those movies you can kind of go back to, and it sort of keeps revealing little moments and little pieces that are just really... Something that struck me about it watching it this last time was the sequence at the Chinese rest. There's like the sequence at the Chinese restaurant, which also is wonderful because I can't tell. It's like one of these things, like, did he intend for the shot to be so janky? There's like this wonderful thing. I think he's like he's like dollying through the restaurant, because also as he pulls back, you see that there are like chairs and tables that are oriented in a way that there was no straight shot for him to go backwards. So as you see, he's like probably like weaving through these tables. And somehow it remains sort of steady, but not really. It's actually bumping along the restaurant, which I thought was like unbelievably funny. And like, I have to assume it was on purpose. Like, let's just assume. But even if it wasn't, for him to just be like, you know what, that's like where they're at as people. So like, let's just keep it, because it's a great shot, you know. And the way that it's articulated is like this wonderful little, like, it's like this, you know, like this foreshot. And they're all sitting at the table eating, and it's insane. And also, it's a wonderful thing that I realized last night. I was like, oh, this was almost all improvised. You can also, you can tell when great actors are improvising, and when the director was like, just have fun.
Yeah.
And he's just like, probably just put the camera and just left it rolling for like 10 minutes or so, and then just spliced it together. This whole sequence of like Amanda Plummer trying to desperately get the lo mein off of the big plate onto her small plate, but then not knowing when to stop.
Yeah.
And like, kind of like, you know, as you do with noodle dishes, you sort of like try to like pull it apart, but it pulls a big bundle onto your plate instead. But she has no sort of like social like cues, so she just kind of keeps letting it pour out onto her plate. And then this like perfect back and forth that like she and Perry have, like whacking this like broccoli back and forth across the table. And then you see Robin Williams kind of getting into that improvisational place where he's just playing with her. And then like the two, like, you know, Jeff Bridges and Mercedes are there just kind of like audience members to this perfect little like comedic sketch that they're devising. And then I feel like there's something about that felt so organic and so unscripted, which I think it must have been just by the look of it. And then you pull out, and as Terry like pulls out and weaves through the restaurant as you're pulling back, you realize that whoever remains in the restaurant, which seems to be probably like the lone waiter who like has been just like desperately trying to get home since like whenever the hell time his shift was over, and then like a couple other stragglers, they're all kind of, it's everything is, they're all, everybody's chairs and tables are directed toward their table, in a way that it seems like that's like the show, that this is the show, and everybody's sort of in on it, which in a way is like not anything like super intellectual, it doesn't feel like, but there's something about that there's something so theatrical about real life sometimes, that he's able to articulate it in such a way that I was like, oh, this is beautiful. It gives like Robin a stage to do his thing, and also it's part of this like perfect kind of flirtation that I just remember, like, as I was watching it again, I was like, oh, this is like so hard to tell somebody to do. You just have to like put the right people in the right place and just say like, here you go. And I feel like, and then there's like this little like addendum on that scene where they like bust out through the back and you only see their shadows. It's a beautiful shot where like they're the like Mercedes and Jeff are heading out through the, like what seems to be like the back door in like Soho or something, because it's like these massive cobblestone streets. and he does this kind of like Dick Tracy sort of massive like shadow on a big wall, and so everything is kind of like hyper pronounced, and they're giggling and laughing, and you watch them kind of fall in love again right after this moment in that Chinese restaurant sequence where her like bra strap has dropped and she puts it back up and he pulls it back down. It's like these little like, you know, mini flirtations within this, like within something so much bigger. And then they go home and you're like, oh, that's so incredible. Just through like that one gesture, and for the two of them able to laugh together and both kind of meet in the same place after you watch them kind of like scrambling throughout the movie to just connect in a real way. You watch it. It's not through anything that they've done. It's actually them as audience members to this other love affair that has them falling back in love again. And there's something about that that's so lovely. Like, it gets me. It really got me this time because it's just simple and it's really beautiful. And it's really hard to allow actors to do that, and also find a director who can live in that space and have it be sort of so subtle. And anyway,
yeah, it doesn't feel like a studio picture. It doesn't feel like a. Like
not at all.
Whatever it would have been pitched as.
Right.
How do you even see
that? What would have that, like, what was that meeting? What was it? He's like, I got this idea. Like, go on.
Yeah.
Like, got this guy, right? Yeah. He's crazy.
And then it's like, give it to Gilliam. He'll make it work.
Yeah,
and
right.
It is such a bizarre sell to, I mean, if you remember the posters at the time were this weird mashup of images with like a shot of Bridges in a corner. And
just,
what is this movie? And it ultimately became, like, the Criterion Laserdisc was just a shot of Bridges kind of holding on to Williams as he goes spinning off. That was the thing.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
In the olden days of Criterion, Laserdiscs would just use a still. They wouldn't go with posters.
Right.
And it was an illustrative image, and it's like, yeah, that's exactly what this is. There's this maniac trying to pull Jeff Bridges into doing something.
right.
That's how you sell it. But I remember trying to explain it to people at the time. I was like, well, is it a big fantasy? It's like, kind of.
Yeah, right.
And the title with Terry Gilliam's name on it makes you expect a big medieval film, but it's not that at all, except that it also is.
right.
It's
yeah, right.
It's still an impossible sell to explain to people. You have to see it to understand the tone.
Yeah, it's one of those, it feels like if he wasn't who he was, that movie wouldn't have been made.
Yeah.
It's like you almost have to just be like, well, Gilliam will do it.
Yeah.
It's like somebody with that kind of, like, it's just somebody with that kind of like rigorous imagination can make this thing come to life.
And get people to trust him, I think, and get the actors to do that. Because Williams was, this is 1991, he was all over the place, he was doing dramas, he was doing comedies, he'd just done Dead Poets Society the year before.
Yeah.
It's not where you expect to end up.
right. I think I was watching the Larry Sanders show, where he was like one of these, like, you know, faux guests, and that was like, I think that was in 92 or something, and I was just like, that was the first thing that struck me too. I was like, God, where was Robin Williams at this time? This was like, I think it was 92 or 93. Must have been, I don't remember when that show started. I think it was 92.
I think so, yeah.
And he comes and he's like, you know, he's on the Larry Sanders show in this full green suit with dyed blonde hair. And I'm just like, was this like, I'm like, you know, because Robin, he was so prolific and did so many different things.
Yeah.
They were like, was this like Mork and Mindy time? Or was this like this time? Or like, when was this movie? And like, when is he, how did the public perceive him at that time? And like, did anybody ever have a grasp on him? Like, was he always just this kind of arbitrary kind of like clown, or was
that's
he?
That's absolutely how he was, like, the late 70s introduced him that way. And he just because I think the nature of his talk show persona was to babble.
Yeah.
That was always who he was.
And,
you know, like, you never saw the depressive side in public. He would talk about, he would reference it, but then laugh it off in interviews.
Right.
And he's someone who's, you know, his story is incredibly fascinating. It's the first comedy album he did has this little throwaway where he asks the audience for a suggestion and someone says Mork, and whether or not it was written, like, whether or not this was banked for him.
Where you just like...
Yeah, he just says, no, that's why I do this, is to do something different.
Right.
It's just like, yeah, that sounds sad.
Yeah.
That actually sounds like he's pained that he has to explain this to people.
Yeah,
that he,
yeah.
He gets, you know, this is the curse of the Fonz, too. Right? Like, Gary Marshall was so good at packaging things that you do that show and you become that thing.
Right, and he's like, no, I'm not. And then you spend an entire career like trying to disavow that one thing that like people will remember you for, which I think he did pretty well, to be fair.
Yeah, my God,
look at that. I mean, look at, you want to talk about like an oeuvre. Look at that guy. Like what he was able to accomplish is astonishing. And it's just like, it's like, and you think about it in terms of like careers today and you're like, who would be given the liberty to do or who has like the, who's proactive and like off the wall enough that they could maybe like, who would you compare that to? Like James Franco? And he's a lunatic. Yeah. Like, bless his heart. But
I think that's why he pulls off.
And I think that's the thing. It's like, don't you dare put me in, like, don't put baby in a corner. Like, it's, there's, he's like, I refuse to be perceived as this.
Yeah.
So I will do everything in my power to just like fend off, you know, that kind of like the box.
But he had that thing too, the need to be loved.
Yeah.
The desperation to be loved by an audience, which led to stuff like Jack and Jacob the Lion.
Right.
Really mawkish stuff that doesn't work.
Right.
But in The Fisher King, the desperation's part of the character. So it works.
I mean,
he's feeding that thing in himself, or it's feeding him.
Right.
And you there's so much pain, there's so much sadness and misery in Perry that you just want him. It's one of those movies where, again, with Terry Gilliam, I want everything to be okay, and even though I know it probably won't.
right.
And that's the vibe of a Gilliam film, too, is this sort of clear-eyed hope.
Right.
Brazil, Munchausen, you know, these films don't end well for their heroes.
No, not at all.
But this one, and I think
there's such like a deep hope that still resonates within that, like within the character. You're like, well, I don't know if I can keep going, but he'll keep going.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about that that's like really flips it on its head. And you're just like, you end up still rooting for somebody, even though you see how desperately the odds are stacked against them as people. Yeah, it's like what happens now. Like so now Robin Williams has like woken up from his coma. His wife is dead, but he's like, but the hope is there. The hope is now alive that he can move forward somehow. Like you will give him the, even though you just know if this was a real person in the real world, that person would be doomed to like, you know, endless hours of like, you know, a shock therapy. I mean, I don't even know what you think of.
Just to walk the earth in misery, right?
Yeah, like just like doomed
to what he's already been doing, but now with self-awareness, which is even worse.
Yeah, there's something about that that's, but somehow he kind of like frames it in a way that you're like, let's be hopeful.
Yeah.
Like,
well, he's got, God, he's got Jack. It. He's got a support system now that he didn't have before.
Right.
And this is the thing that fascinates me. Why does Terry Gilliam need to make a Don Quixote movie? This is it.
Right.
He did it.
Yeah,
he did it. And he cured the guy, so it's okay.
Right.
I suppose if you look at it, both Brazil and Munchausen are also about sort of questing figures that achieve the, or determined to achieve the impossible.
Yeah.
12 Monkeys, not so much, even though there is a quest narrative there.
Right.
I know I've told this story. When I was at the junket, Chuck Rovin, the producer, Rovin and Gilliam were seated together for the round table, and they started arguing over what the ending of 12 Monkeys means.
Oh, God.
Rovin's like, not everyone understood the film, because...
Wait, how does it end?
In the 90s. It's on the... After the Vertigo thing, Willis watches... The young Willis watches his older self get killed. Who is it? David Morse, I think, sits down on an airplane to depart from Baltimore Airport and sits down to one of the scientists from the future who says, her name is Jones.
Oh, yeah.
I need insurance, right? That's the last line.
Oh, God. Oh, it's so messed up.
Yeah, but so what What we are presumed to be, because the whole point of the time travel was that they needed the pure sample of the virus, so that's, she's insurance. She's the insurance policy in case Cole fails.
Right,
so she's there
to
save the future.
Right.
And Rovin starts saying, well, no, not necessarily. I mean, maybe she's there to stop the virus there. Maybe they're going to stop it from getting out and it won't spread any further. And Gilliam started, like, sitting at the table going, no, Chuck, everybody dies. Yeah. We talked about this. Billions of people. It says so at the beginning of my movie. It says billions of people die. And they're fighting over it. And it's like, I love you so much and I will follow you.
Like everywhere you go.
You're pushing for this upbeat, downbeat ending.
Yeah.
It was so great. And now, like, seeing what he's still trying to accomplish, and he's doing the Quixote thing again. Zero Theorem, I can take it or leave it.
Yeah,
but
I did see it.
It's definitely a Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah.
Like, he made the movie he wanted to make. It's set in this gargantuan old European church.
I saw the whole, like,
visuals.
Right.
And Matt Damon, who Worked with him on Brothers Grimm, which was butchered by Miramax, but probably wasn't all that great to begin with. Like, again, it's this lush, beautiful production, but it's messy, and you can sort of tell that Gilliam didn't have full control over what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But that Damon and Ledger both worked with him again and would contribute, and clearly Ledger would have still been collaborating with him because they were totally in sync. You can feel it in Parnassus.
Yeah.
Christopher Plummer had nothing but great things to say about him, and Christopher Plummer doesn't have great things to say about anybody.
I know, yeah.
It's just...
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite humans, not just people, but I want him to work forever and whatever he's doing. I want the Quixote thing to happen, but if it doesn't, we still have this.
Right, right.
And it is... Like, it's the best articulation, I think, that we're ever going to get of it from Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, that fits within the kind of, like, mainstream mold that you can kind of, like... watch it and appreciate it and not have to go and like pull up the encyclopedia to be like, so what was this and what is he trying to, and how are we gonna has that thing that's like, so it feels like every great book you've ever read where there's something about it that seems so much bigger than it is. Maybe that's the thing that like really consistently draws me to it. Hmm. Or draws me back to it. There's, like I was saying earlier, but kind of like, you know, there's still new layers that you're kind of peeling back. It becomes a tricky thing unless you kind of like find these like masterpieces, which I don't know if this is like a masterpiece. It's somewhere in the vein of like a great work, but there's something about it that he almost, you know, it's like you can tell it's not James Cameron directing the movie because he didn't need it to be this kind of like grand statement on humanity. Instead it ends up being this kind of like, you know, it feels kind of like a chamber quartet's version of like a grand statement on humanity.
Yeah.
It's like
bigger stuff is outside the frame.
Yeah. There's something else that he's going for that feels in a way that can be kind of like, you know, I don't know. Maybe it is his like a version of his opus or something. There's like, I don't know, you know, maybe there's something grand and magnum about it.
I can see that.
I don't know.
I can certainly... I mean, I guess we have to see what else is left, what else he's got coming. But as far as it goes, this is just... I think anybody would be proud to have it on their shelf as an accomplishment.
Right.
So then this brings us to the closer, which is also always the same question, which is what of the film have you borrowed or stolen or internalized? What of The Fisher King has made it into your creative DNA?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's really hard not to just make it exclusively about Robin Williams at this point. Okay. From like thinking about how incredible it is to watch a human being allow themselves to be vulnerable, and how that's something that is like really. It's like a daily work as a human being, let alone like as an actor, to just allow yourself to be so thin-skinned, which is like, you know, it runs completely counter to everything you're instructed to do as a person to be able to get by in the world. It's like, toughen up, make sure you don't, like, don't let it sticks and stones. And like, you know, there's something about that, You watch somebody like Robin Williams perform, and you know, when you're talking about clowning, I've had like the wonderful privilege to do that, to do clowning and work with really great clowns in my, you know, in my days. And there's a really lovely idea that we talk about in terms of clowning, that you have to be the a skinless grape.
Okay.
just like, I feel like it's just something, if you close your eyes for a second and think about a skinless grape, I think, you know, I don't have to say anything about it. Yeah. It's just like, you get it. And it's like, not even a grape that has skin on it that is that vulnerable, that can be like squished and mashed and thrown with such ease, but actually take the skin off of that, and it's that much more delicate. And there's something about great clowns that they have such an ability to be affected and such an innocence about them that when you put it in the package of a character, like, you know, let's take this little grape that has no skin on it and let's make him a college professor who has recently lost his wife because of like a in a mass shooting, and let's throw that up and see what lands. Mm-hmm. and then you take you know, Robin Williams and put that narrative, let him play with it, and you come and you have this character that is such like depth and such kind of like gravitas, and also is like a little boy. And it's this impossible balance, which like no teacher can teach, no amount of words can explain. But there's something about it when you watch somebody great doing something that seems just, along with like so much else that he's done, but seems in this particular character to be so like elevated and so vulnerable and so broken and so like optimistic and so ashamed, and these like really incredible kind of like opposite ideas. There's something about watching that is like, as an audience member, it makes me excited and makes me like cry. It makes me cry and makes me like, you know, just empathize so deeply with him. And then like as an actor, I'm just like, golly, that's something to aim toward. You know, that's something to like look at and be like, wow, that's impressive. So I think it's, you know, to allow yourself to be impressed. I mean, for me, that's something that like it still keeps me going. I'm like, when I watch something great, I'm like, geez, well, maybe at some point that's something I could do. Like maybe if I really dig in deep. And so I think that's something I take away from it as I watch. I mean, that could be said for almost everybody in the movie, but there's something about Robin that feels really, also knowing what his life was and knowing how the little bits and pieces that we have of like the pain and the anxiety and the incredible artistry that came out of that. And you look and you watch that. I think it's so fully realized in that character, in this character of Perry, that you see all of you can see the joy and the sadness and the optimism and the despair and all of that wrapped up. It's really hard to watch, but also really illuminating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I can see that.
Yeah.
So. Also jokes about bowel movements.
You gotta put those in there. You gotta get some poop jokes in there, or you're really doomed.
He makes them land.
Literally.
My thanks to Aaron Costaganis, whom you can see in Tim Kirkman's Lazy Eye right now on iTunes and on other VOD platforms. And you should. It's a good movie for a slow holiday week, and he's really great in it. Thanks also to Jonah Blackman. He knows what he did. You can find Aaron on Twitter at Aaron Costaganis, all one word, and you can find The Fisher King on Blu-ray and DVD in the Criterion Collection, finally, and for sale or rental on iTunes and Google Play. It remains as magnificent now as it was 25 years ago. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. Have a happy new year, and thanks for listening.
All of us, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.